Okay, everybody, welcome to concurrent session, whichever one it is, 3D. So this one is on establishing effective risk cultures leading through influence. So we've got a couple of Doyens here with us, Sean McGing and Andrew Brown. It's going to be the Sean and Andrew show. This is a workshop. You will be participating and you have to, be part of the action. So get all strapped in and be ready to have a bit of fun. So it's not going to be quite the normal format that you're used to. It's more of a workshop, quite a few questions that the guy's going to take us through. So it should be fun. So look, I'll just quickly, for those who don't know Sean and Andrew, which I suspect is probably about two people in the room, basically Sean has been combining actuarial and risk management knowledge and experience for over 25 years, mainly in life insurance, wealth and superannuation. He's carried out projects in health insurance, banking, retirement villages, education and utilities as well. Sean's been running his own boutique personal consulting firm, McGing Advisory and Actuarial in Melbourne since 2010. Prior to that, Sean started a little firm called Ascot Consulting back in 1999, which later merged into Ernst & Young, and where he became a partner. Andrew, on the other hand, on my far left, your far right, is an expert in strategic organisation development and leadership. He has extensive experience in building talent and organisational capability. He specialises in embedding contemporary organisation development strategies to respond to and catalyse, that's a good word, major change through aligning interests of shareholders, employees, communities and customers. Through Andrew's leadership development consulting business, Andrew partners with corporations, community groups in building leading cultures. So that's our two gurus, and I'll hand over to them, and my job's pretty well done now because I'm going to sit back and watch the show with you guys.
Thanks very much, Greg. I suppose I should really ask everyone to move up a bit towards the front. Would you mind doing that? Please. So it'll make it easier for the interaction. Oh, that'd be great. You don't have to come right up to the front seat, but you're more than welcome to. Yeah. Why not? Excellent. You can throw the tomatoes from there too, you know. That's great. Thank you for that. Okay. Establishing effective risk cultures. That requires you to influence people so that they change their behavior. And we're going to take a reality check on that because it is very, very hard. This quote from Douglas Adams says, "Human beings who are almost unique in having the ability to learn from the experience of others are also remarkable for their apparent disinclination to do so." It never ceases to amaze me what a wide range of behaviors people can come up with. That means there's opportunities to change that behavior en route. Our aim today is to help you learn some of those influences and how you can change either your own behavior or the behavior of your organization over time. And really, that's about a greater awareness of the risks around you, because we do have an enterprise risk management focus around what we're doing here, creating a good risk culture in an organization. So the next 45 minutes will be interactive. Within that limited time, we'll cover several themes. And in particular, we'll cover seven key insights. So something for you to take home with after that, if you listen. And that'll help you recognize risks as you go along. I'm going to hand over to Andrew now, and he'll take you through a bit of fun.
Thank you, Sean. I've attended a couple of other sessions today which have got some very similar themes to what we're going to explore in the next 45 minutes. As Sean said, there's seven themes that we've looked at around human behaviour and how it impacts on risks that emerge in an organisation. The first one that we're going to look at is what I call paying attention. Where do we actually put our attention to? Now, I'm seeing a few smiles in the room, so I suspect a few people have seen this before. What I'm going to invite you to do, there's going to be a video that comes up in a minute, and you can see on the screen at the moment three people in white, three people in black. The white person with the basketball is a black person. What I'm going to invite you to do is with the people with white t-shirts to count the number of times they pass the ball to each other. Now be very careful, pay very close attention to that because there is a trick in this video. I'm warning you right now. So with that in mind, your job is to count as many times as you can how many times do the people with the white t-shirts pass the ball to each other. Ready to go?
The monkey business illusion. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball.
Okay. So how many times do the white people pass the ball to each other? 16. Just quick show of hands, 16. Oh, most people counted 16. Excellent. 17. Were there any 17s, 15s? Okay. What else did people notice? A monkey? What was that monkey? What was the monkey about? So there was a monkey that seemed to float right across the screen. Just quick show of hands if you saw a monkey. Okay, about three quarters of the room. Excellent. Quick show of hands if you hadn't seen the monkey. Okay, a few people. Quick show of hands if you've seen that before. All right, about three quarters of the room. What else did you see apart from the monkey? What else did you see?
Black guys.
What about the black guys?
One.
Yeah, one of the black people disappeared. One of the black t-shirts. Anything else? Curtains in the background turned from red to orange. Okay, curtains in the background turned from red to orange. Now, rather than playing that video again, which we often do, there's just some key themes and key learnings that come through from that. Right? The first piece is in organisations, we often focus our attention on counting. Yeah? We focus our attention on things like performance, on things like goals. The challenge and the dark side of that is what we don't pay attention to. And sometimes we don't pay attention to the gorillas in the room. In this particular room, you did very well and you counted the gorillas. But even if we see the gorilla, sometimes we miss the changing of the curtain. Sometimes we miss the black person disappearing off the screen. So the opportunity we have to reflect on is where do we put our energy? One of the expressions that I really love is energy flows where attention goes based on our intention. When we place our intention on counting the gorillas or counting the basketballs in the room, we often miss other things. So this is our first critical insight. Sean, over to you for the next one.
Probably just worth saying there that when Andrew normally does that particular exercise, 75% of the people in his workshop has not seen it before. and not as many people notice the gorilla passing through and the other elements, of course. Okay. The second theme that we have is around relying on our own experience. So this is a key insight. The video we just watched was it really all about gorillas and basketballs? Surely we don't have those kinds of limited perspectives if we're the experts in an area. So we'll explore this through some infamous statements that people have made over the years, which all turn out to be horribly wrong. A little hindsight's a wonderful thing, but notwithstanding that, let's have a look at the increased risk that might emerge if you don't actually believe what your entrenched view is. So the first one, Captain Smith of the Titanic. I cannot conceive of any vital disaster happening to this vessel. Modern shipbuilding has gone beyond that. Well, how did that work out? We know what happened. And what about renowned economist Irving Fisher in 1929? The stock market has reached a permanently high plateau. And, of course, what transpired? That's quite a dip. And here's a reliance on an expert, especially for those of you who work in life insurance and are charged with mortality risk assessments. In 1954, smoking was fashionable and romantic even. And Wilhelm Hopper was the person in charge of the National Cancer Institute at the time, 1954, and he said, if excessive smoking actually plays a role in the production of lung cancer, it seems to be a minor one. And contrast that to today's anti-smoking ads. In more recent times, chairman of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, said in 2005, although a bubble in home prices for the nation as a whole does not appear likely, there do appear to be at a minimum signs of froth in some local markets where home prices seem to have risen to unsustainable levels. So he was picking up some of the story, but that unlikely bubble burst, and what a whack. And that's the US line there. Canada didn't quite fall in the same way. So there's a theme running through all these slides, that at times we can downplay the risks and even not be aware of the risks, because we can get overconfident, we can get that entrenched view within ourselves and not see the potential of alternatives. Despite that well-worn phrase used in illustration projections that past experience is not necessarily a guide to the future, we believe that human beings, particularly so-called experts, have a tendency to over-rely on our current knowledge and past experience and underestimate potential impacts of possible events that don't fit into our entrenched views at the time. And did I mention we can be quite sensitive about those things? Ouch. Nobody likes being told they're wrong. Nobody likes being found they're wrong. And that doesn't help open debate, which is another key theme. You need to be open about these things, open to the possibilities of something not being how you see it. The leadership and culture response required is to encourage curiosity and inquiry. Have that open mind. Talk to others. Listen. Get the feedback. And learn is a great way to having a greater capability in terms of understanding your market and really seeing the risks and opportunities that might arise, and less chance of shocks or surprises. Back to Angie.
Thank you, Sean. Third area we're going to look at is about loss aversion versus risk aversion. Now I'm going to invite you to participate in a bit of an exercise here. Imagine that for your good grace of coming along to the Actuary Summit today, you get $1,000. I'm going to provide you $1,000 in your hot little hand right here and now. How does that feel? It's all right? Yep, you could do that. Now, in addition to that, I'm requesting that you take up one of the following two options. Option A is that I'm going to toss a coin. If it's heads, I'm going to give you an extra $1,000. If it's tails, I'm going to give you nothing. So option A is you flip a coin and you'll either get you'll walk away with $1,000 or $2,000. Option B, I'm going to give you $500, no questions asked. Okay, now don't overthink this. I'm going to ask you to go with your gut. Those who want to go with option A, can you put your hands up now? Okay, about half a dozen people. Those who are going with option B. Okay, good group of actuaries there. We take the money and run. Fantastic. Let's go to a slightly different case. In this instance, for coming along today, I'm going to give you $2,000. All right, not just $1,000. You know, this time you get $2,000. But there's a caveat attached. You can have one of two choices. Choice number one is we flip the coin. If it's heads, you get to give me $1,000 back. If it's tails, you get to keep the loss, the lot. Or option number two, you can give me back a guaranteed $500, no questions asked. Okay. Going with your gut, who's going to go with option A? Okay, about half the room. Who's going with option B? About half the room. So what happened there? Just let's explore that for a second. The first instance, you had possible outcomes. The second instance, you had the same possible outcomes. But the actual way that people voted changed. Why was that?
People don't like losing.
People don't like losing, yeah. I've done this experiment in about 40 different seminars with groups of actuarial students at Melbourne Uni, with CAP program, with people across different organisations, with miners, with a whole heap of different groups, and exactly the same thing happens every single time. People are loss averse. We're not necessarily risk averse. Right? Now that is huge consequences, and here we are, a group of actuaries, the rational minds of the world, yet in the same way, sometimes we will change. Yeah? Because people don't like to give away something they've already got. In the second instance, you already had the $2,000. That plays out in a lot of ways in the workforce. And some of the ways that it can play out is that people don't want to give away status. They don't want to give away credibility. They don't want to give away things which will impact on their position. Right? People will fight for that. There's another thing that it does, which means that we often focus on not losing rather than focusing on what's the opportunity through risk. And there's a lot of famous case studies about organisations when they've been protecting a market, the actions they've taken versus those who are open to the new market. So let's just look at one case study. Apple and Sony, the year's 2005. A new company comes up called LimeWire. Does anyone know what LimeWire's business was? LimeWire, anyone young enough in the room? Yeah? Downloading free music. Yeah. Now, who in society would have been downloading free music? Teenage kids, right? So Sony had a music business, Apple didn't. How did Sony respond to that? They put teenage kids on stand and prosecuted them. Brilliant move. Imagine what that's going to do to a global brand to be prosecuting teenagers for downloading free music. Right? What did Apple do? They created iTunes. They asked themselves that question, in the face of music being downloaded, how can we create a business out of that where we can charge a margin but do it in a way where we can make a profit? And they created a multi-billion dollar business. So what's our critical insight number three? We're often loss averse rather than risk averse. People may be prepared to take significant risks to avoid loss, whether that be loss of status, loss of credibility, loss of remuneration. You don't have to look very hard in financial circles to do that. You only have to look at some of the rebel traders, some of the rogue traders. I've worked for organisations before where the CFO I was reporting to used to have a policy of no surprises. Huh? That was fantastic, worked beautifully. Guess what happened? The CFO got no surprises until a lot further down the track when they're a lot larger and a lot nastier. Right? So one of the challenges there is when we don't have a psychologically safe environment, when we get punished for actually identifying risk, guess what people will do? They'll hide the risk. So one of the key themes here is how do we need to respond? We need to create environments where it's okay to raise risks, where transparency is rewarded and where there's more to gain than to lose by genuinely focusing on risk and the opportunity from risk. Insight number four, and is anyone who was in Kent Hopper's session just before, Kent actually referred to this, and it's about discounting uncertainty and what we do as human beings when there are uncertain future events. There was a study done by Stanford University where they had two groups of financial advisors, and one group of financial advisors had no software, no other tools, but when their client came to see them, they had a group of clients. The clients are asked the question, what would you do if you were to give an extra $1,000? How much of that would you invest in your pension plan or superannuation? Okay. So that was group number one. Group number two were asked to bring a photo along of themselves. The advisor had a piece of software where the photo was uploaded and it transposed what that person would look like at their retirement age. So if they said they were going to retire at 65, it transposed and gave an image of them at 65. If they said they were going to retire at 70, it transposed and gave an image of them at 70. Who do you think would be more likely to invest more in superannuation in that $1,000? The first group or the second group? Yeah. Why the second group? It makes it real. Yeah. So what you can actually see here, for the first group of $1,000, they would invest on average $70. The second group invested on average $170. Right, now, one way of looking at that from a superannuation perspective is one's putting in 7% of their discretionary income, one's putting in 17%. You get quite significant outcome differences in superannuation in that regard. Right, what's the link here to risk? The link here to risk is that when there are risks which are a long way off and unclear or abstract, genuine risks may be ignored. People will discount them. So what do we need to do? What's the response there? From an actuarial perspective, how do we increase the ability to touch, feel and understand the potential risks? One of the ways is using methods such as scenario planning, anything that brings the future into today, anything so people can actually sit inside that, see and experience it. Very much like, as that gentleman said, bringing that photo forward and making it real. Okay. So, what else do we have? Critical insight number five. We've got, we're going to go through for about another 5 or 10 minutes and then we're going to explore some questions around this and see how these relate back to your organisation. So on the board here, we have two questions. Question one, which of these have you observed in your organisation? And question two, what have been the consequences or potential consequences? So we're going to invite you, just as we're going through this, just to reflect on that, see what comes up. The fifth example is around systems thinking. This is a true story from the 1990s and a particular car release. In this particular car company, they had a very, very successful new model being released. They sold hundreds of thousands of cars. They were making tens of millions of dollars. About 4 months after the car was sold, they started getting a lot of cars coming back and being recalled. And the cars were recalled because the tyres on the cars were wearing more rapidly than they should have been. And there are many, many cars that are being recalled. And so they sent in a specialist, and the specialist found that the nuts on the tyres were out by a minute amount. And it wouldn't be discernible to the human eye or not to an expert, but it was out by a small enough amount that meant that the wheels weren't aligned properly and the tyres were wearing really quickly. Cost the company tens of millions of dollars. They went back to the part of the assembly line to understand what was happening. The guy there who was in charge said, well, we'd actually been asked to save $10,000 a year out of our budget, right, as a management initiative on expense cutting. We did that. Right? But what happened, one of the ways we did that is we had these nuts left over from a previous release of the car. They looked exactly the same, so we used them. Right? Acting out a positive intention. Yeah? Putting a previous version of a nut and causing tens of million dollars of damage or carnage. Does that ever happen in your organisations? Right? Does it ever happen that someone does something with well-intended but has consequences which they can't see immediately because the car's being assembled in the factory but it's being run on the road? And by the way, there's 6 or 9 or 12 month lag. A little bit similar to the group insurance conversation today about the lag in information from the impacts of things that we do. Okay. So what's the insight? In complex systems, cause and effect are often separated by distance and time. We can respond by creating mechanisms to reduce the distance time gap, or we can kick the can down the road. I can't tell you how many times I've been in meetings when a particular issue's come up in an organisation and people have said, look, we don't need to worry about this now because the risk is only going to emerge after our careers are long gone. That will be for someone else to fix up. Has anyone here ever heard that before? Yeah? Right? So the challenge there is, what's the legacy we want to leave? Do we want to leave a legacy of sustainability, or do we want to leave a legacy of someone else cleaning up our mess? The response required in a system is for information flows quickly and effectively through the organisation as and when required. Now, for that to happen, it's not a matter of just IT systems. It's not just a matter of processes and protocols. It's actually a matter of human intervention. It's understanding the human aspects of the system that you may not see, but if you have that insight or that understanding, will make a very, very big difference to how those risks are managed. Yeah? For me, it's about understanding broadly enough that when something occurs in my part of the business and it has an effect on someone else, I can actually let them know. So let's go to critical insight number six, the influence of authority. This research comes from a gentleman called Robert Cialdini, who wrote a very famous book called The Psychology of Influence. And he looked at those in the business of influence and how they actually influenced or manipulated other people. So it's a great read if you ever want to realise what's been happening when you suddenly bought an item that you never really wanted. Cialdini goes through and he talks about all the things that people do. One of them is what he calls the influence of authority, or the white coat of authority. And he set up an experiment, and in the experiment that Cialdini set up, He had a person who was paid as an actor, two paid actors, and let's say one of the paid actors was sitting where that gentleman was sitting and one of the paid actors was here. There was then a person who came off the street and they weren't aware that there were actors, and that person was asked to sit down and in front of them there was a button. The paid actor on this side of the glass perspex screen would ask that person to press a button. The person on the other side, the other paid actor, would have electrodes attached to their head. When they press the button, this person would start going, "Oh," and vibrating violently as if they were getting an electric shock. Now, the paid actor here will then tell that person to press the button a second time. Now, this is the crux of the experiment. If the person who was telling them to press the button was wearing jeans and a T-shirt, they might press the button a second time. They'd see the person revolting a second time and then they would stop doing it and they'd refuse to do it. But if the person in my situation was wearing a white coat with trousers, black shoes and a tie, how many times do you think that person would press the button? Up to 7 times, right? With this person on the other side starting to drool out of their mouth, looking like they're having a psychotic experience as they're getting electrocuted time and time again. The person would plead to stop, but they would continue up to 7 times. Okay? That's the white coat of authority. How many times in our organisations are we asked to do things that we know are inappropriate? Right? How many times are people asked to do things that sit outside their values frame, but they go along with because of the white coat of authority? Absolutely critical part of risk management, absolutely critical insight is how do we make sure we create cultures where we're not asked to do those things? How do we create cultures where the people who lead are doing things congruent with the organisation's values? So what is the response required? Create an environment where it's appropriate to respectfully challenge the status quo. Again, it comes down to psychological safety. It comes down to the culture of the organisation. Leaders to role model the desirable behaviours and attitudes. And leadership in that instance might be not telling someone to press a button when it's going to electrocute someone. And leadership might be saying no if you ask to do that. One last insight before we move into exploring these themes as a plenary group. This gentleman here is a fellow called Daniel Kahneman. He looks like his hair's a little bit electrocuted. Daniel Kahneman wrote a book called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. People might have heard of that. It was quite a bestseller recent times. He also won the Nobel Prize in 2002 in economics. What was really interesting about that is Daniel Kahneman is not an economist. He's a psychologist. And he won his Nobel Prize in the field of behavioural finance. And one of his key themes was that vivid examples are overwhelmingly more influential in shaping decisions than abstract information, even if the information is more accurate. So what that means is you can give someone a sea of numbers, a whole heap of data points which all point in the same one direction, or you could tell them a particular story, one data point, and they're going to be more influenced by the story. Okay? Believe it or not, it calls this the power of narrative. I'll just share with you an example. In the late 1990s, I was working in mergers and acquisitions, and I used to work very late. And I was getting a taxi home one evening, and the taxi driver said to me, I said, "Mate, what do you do?" And I said, "I work in finance." And he said, "Oh, yeah, what kind of role?" And I said, "I'm an actuary." And he started laughing. And I said, "Well, why are you laughing?" And he said, "Oh, mate," he said, "oh, I used to work as a life insurance agent." He said, "You know, you're actuaries, you're real clever bastards, but I tell you, you have no idea how to sell anything." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, look, if you were to sell a policy, a life insurance policy to a client, you'd probably show them a mortality table, a sea of premium rates, and their life expectancy." He said, "When I sell a policy to someone, I share with them the story of my mate Norm." He said Norm was 40. He had 3 kids and a mortgage and a wife. He was diagnosed with stomach cancer. He didn't have any insurance. 6 months later, he died and he left his wife to clean up the mess. Who are you going to buy insurance from? That's the power of narrative. It makes emotional connection. Yeah? The challenge and the dark side is we can also start drinking the Kool-Aid. So it's not just about individual narrative, it's about the collective narratives. Let's not forget about the weapons of mass destruction, drinking the Kool-Aid, the Western world believing in the weapons of mass destruction. CDOs in America just before the GFC, the dot-com valuations for those who were around in the early 2000s. property prices in Australia today, property prices in Melbourne. Huh? To me, these are things where people believe they're going to continue on. We get sucked into the narrative. We get sucked into the Kool-Aid. So what's the response required? We need to embed in our organisation narratives which are congruent with a risk-effective culture. Narratives about the times when people were transparent. Stories about sharing of information, taking responsibility and how they made the biggest difference. Only by doing that can we move forward. So there are our seven insights. Let's just do a summary of those and then we'll explore them from there.
Thanks, Andrew. So seven insights. Maybe I should ask someone to repeat them all. That'd be a bit unfair, wouldn't it? Yeah, it's only... We won't go to that extreme. We've put them on a slide for you. So what we'd like to do after we go through these seven items is for you to think about those two questions that are on the right-hand side, and we'll have a minute or two for you to discuss that with the person next to you, and then we'll ask you for your thoughts and share those. So the first one is paying attention. Energy flows where attention goes based on our intention. We do tend to overly focus on the counting and not the other elements that are happening, as we saw earlier in the video. Secondly, we rely on our expertise too much. And the more expert we are, the more we tend to do that. That has serious consequences for underestimating the potential impacts of future events and hence the risk processes around identifying those and putting mitigations in place beforehand. Number three, loss averse. We are often loss averse rather than risk averse. The other side of that is we may take undue risk in actually maintaining our status, which can lead to worse outcomes. Number four, discounting uncertainty. We are less likely to be concerned about events that are down the track. We are unduly influenced by the concrete and current, and discount or even ignore future or abstract risks. And these things happen unbeknownst to us, despite our being relatively logical and systematic and organized. Number five, systems thinking. Complex systems bring distance and time across several events, and those associations are quite difficult to track in the associative mind. Because of that, we're not always aware of what's happening, and we have limited mechanisms to deal with the outcomes that may arise from that. Number six, the influence of authority, the white coat. Again, subconsciously, we succumb to that much more often than we'd like to think. And you really do have to be aware, self-aware, and be courageous, recognize that, and take the stand that's consistent with your values, which hopefully coincide with the values of the organization you're working for at the time. Seven, the power of narrative. We're heavily influenced by the prevailing groupthink, story, what everybody else believes. And the danger with that is you become blind to alternatives. So coming back to our questions now, which of these issues have you observed in your organisation? Would anybody like to venture an observation in that regard? Don't be shy. Yes, I'll just have a chat with each other maybe first, and then we'll come back. If there's someone beside you, turn and just ask. And we'll give you a minute or two to do that.
Okay, great. So who'd like to make the first observation? You could sell? There is a... Oh, there's a roving mic, or is a mic up there?
Mine's an easy one. I'm working in the Pacific, so I won't name the institution, but it's a big mandatory savings scheme. It's got a flat rate death benefit, so same level of cover depending on what age you are. And I've been going on to them for some time about the huge risks about this and various things dealing with it. I've had no traction, and I can tick practically every one of those boxes as one of the reasons. Do you want? I'm trying to think of which the strongest one is. Loss averse is one of them, because it means older people won't get as much cover. If we change it to age related, or we can't have that, that would be terrible. Influence of authority a bit. You know, I don't have a champion for it within the organisation, so I can't get it to happen. Discounting uncertainty. The chickens are going to come to roost in about 10 years' time, not now. I can tick every box.
Yeah, thank you.
Well done. That's a fantastic 7 out of 7.
If you can give me some clues as to how I can change things, I'd be frustrated.
We'll give you a couple of tips. But it probably all comes back to the humanity that we started off with at the very beginning. Some organisations, people are more open than others. Yeah. Thank you.
So who else had something?
David Whittle from Zurich. I mean, one that, number four, I think it was actually more common in general insurance in the 1990s than subsequently, but discounting uncertainty, you'd have this thing saying commercial lines, general insurance, pretty complex products, complex underwriting. So somebody would say, well, you know, we employ all these underwriters and they do all this stuff. We could get rid of 10% of them and that would be an expense saving that's right. Definite. Mm. Whereas the impact on the loss ratio of that is a much more nebulous thing where it doesn't happen straight away. It's harder to prove the link between getting rid of two of the 20 people in the property underwriting area and, you know, some loss we then had a year and a half later. And yet, you know, I certainly in the 1990s saw, well, one particular general insurer that, you know, cut the expense ratio by 2 points and increased the loss ratio by about 10. Certainly not coincidentally. But, you know, it was very hard even after the event to prove that was the cause. So, you know, I think that's been quite a common one over the years in GI.
Thank you. There's the interesting piece there about the nebulous or the long-term nature of the claims we deal with, claims runoffs and triangles and IBNRs and all those kind of things where there's so much subjectivity. You know, how straightforward is it for a small assumption change which will coincidentally lead to a profit emerging which is in line with analysts' expectations, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I see people wincing in their chairs a little bit uncomfortably. But what else do people have? So thank you. That's a great example.
Jonathan Chu from State Street. So I work in the asset management business and the biggest risk we face is actually operational. Given the way our business works. And there were a couple of things. The first was paying attention. And the idea of counting. I was a little torn, and not just because I'm an actuary, to being told not to count. But our experience was it's what you count. So if you count the times things go wrong, then you actually lose focus. And one of the learnings for us was to expand the field of vision. So you count the near misses, you count anything that didn't quite go to plan, and you use that to broaden your field of vision for what an emergent risk pattern might look like. And the second observation was partly on the power of narrative and partly on discounting uncertainty. We established a process where teams around the globe would share stories about things that went wrong, because you can never conceive about it going wrong until someone shares something that's a little bit close to home. And then you think, oh, gee, I never thought that could happen. I wonder if that happened in Tokyo or if that happened in New York. I wonder whether that could happen here. So it's just a couple of our experiences on the operational risk side.
Great, thank you. I think the part there around that sharing the stories is very powerful. And often when I work with organisations around risk culture, that's one of the encouragements is share the parts where people do it well, but also share the things that haven't worked and what can you learn from it. And it's about what are the learning opportunities that we have.
Yeah, I think just following on from that reminded me of one of the people that Andrew and I interviewed a couple of years ago for one of the preliminary papers we did. Said it's good to get a big crisis every so often, because that's the only way of making risk real to a lot of people. And it's sad that that's the case, but it ties in with your theme of looking at the near misses, looking at what might have happened, but actually being conscious about that so that you do widen the horizons and then you're less taken by surprise. Well, thank you for all that feedback. That's great. So, question was asked, what can we do about it? it is about influencing. So let me share with you some ways that you can do. What can you do to influence? And it's about influencing really the risk culture in your organization, and you know, risk culture is pretty close to culture, the way the organization does things, but particularly from the perspective of risks and opportunities are arising. The first thing that we can do as actuaries or as risk specialists is to pay attention. So number one is pay attention, and to broaden the span of attention, as you were saying there just a few minutes ago. Explore what we don't know as well as what we do know. Explore what's possible. What are the risks and what are the opportunities? So take that wide view. Now, McKinsey came up with three elements around this to help pay attention. The first is ask powerful questions. The second is to provide an environment which encourages multiple perspectives to be shared, to be heard, and then to be considered actively. And actively means identifying and creating forums with a broad diversity of participation and actively focus on what can be learned from that. So that learning part's really important. Thirdly, consider the larger systems in play, and that's both internal and external to your organization. What are the systems that your organization is not conscious of? There's quite a lot going on outside your internal mechanisms. How do current actions flow out through the system, and what are the subsequent risks and consequences, both intended and unintended, that arise from those? The second thing that you can do to influence is to take responsibility. But that's really taking responsibility for the things that are within your control. In our working lives, probably 80% of our interactions are around things that we can't control. It's markets, it's the environment, it's a particular boss perhaps, it's the way the company operates. But there is 20% that is directly within your control. And if you take responsibility for that, you can actually make 80% of the difference at the end of the day. And it's only by taking responsibility for what you can control, and hence the choices that you make, that you truly influence. The third thing you can do is choose how you lead. The more senior the person in the organization, the greater is their authority. Again, whether it's direct or indirect, and the greater impact they have on the culture. So as Andrew and I have identified in our papers the last few years for the summit and the forum, Ed Schein, the leading global researcher on culture, in organizational culture in particular, has observations that are very relevant to influence, and they're relevant to risk culture and the role of leadership. Now, of Ed Schein's top seven influences on
on culture. The top three all relate to leadership. The first one, what a leader attends to, measures, rewards, and controls, influences the organization. The next most positive influence is how leaders react to critical incidents. Do they panic? Do they blame someone? Do they shoot the messenger? Or do they take responsibility, support the organization, and be proactive and help resolve things? And thirdly, leader role modeling. What they do makes all the difference. People can see that. People are not stupid. They can see what's being done right. So how leaders model appropriate behaviors and respond to risk will have a major influence on the organization, both tone from the top and tune from the middle, in terms of the middle management doing those same things. So over to you to rise to the challenge and to help you lead and influence. We'll give you a few takeaways. We can influence the culture and environment we're in through what we pay attention to, the choices we make, and how we model risk-appropriate behaviours. Scenarios and sensitivities are powerful ways to make things real, and hence help you to build the capacity to respond. You can actively seek to learn from the experience of others, and you can create a culture of openness and apply narratives or stories that explore the emerging future rather than the prevailing wisdom. Our workshop design was modelled on what we are looking for in risk-effective cultures, to help people pay attention to the things we may often take for granted and to explore each individual's responsibilities towards creating effective risk cultures. Our view is that it's only through collective responsibility that risk cultures can be truly effective. Thank you for participating today. We appreciate your energy and your ideas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew and Sean. So thank you for everybody else. I think we're all going to vacate the room, but I think for me, one of the interesting things in all this is to remember that half the time we're the guys with the white, or girls with the white coats on. And we've got to remember sometimes to take our own white coats off and get outside and look at things a bit different to what we're doing. But anyway, thank you all very much, and thanks, Sean.